Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, 40% of people consider themselves shy. Whether it's anguish over venturing an answer in class, navigating a dinner party, or ordering from the deli counter, people who suffer from social anxiety are constantly worried that some perceived flaw will be exposed, which can have a real impact on quality of life. Psychologist Ellen Hendrickson describes social anxiety as self-consciousness on steroids. We'll talk to her about the roots of social anxiety, how we can rewire our brains, and how we can quiet our inner critics. Our conversation starts after a short break. Social anxiety is considered a spectrum. Some people feel a little queasy at the idea of giving a speech in front of a crowd of people. Others have intense anxiety about ordering a meal at a restaurant. Sometimes anxiety is a little annoyance. Sometimes it's enough to disrupt a person's career. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Research shows only 1% of people have never experienced any kind of social anxiety, and they're considered sociopaths. For the 99% of us who worry, fret, or melt down in different situations, is there any hope for getting past the panic? Psychologist Ellen Hendrickson says yes, and explores both the roots of anxiety and the light at the end of the tunnel in her new book. It's called How to Be Yourself, Quiet Your Inner Critic and Rise Above Social Anxiety, and she joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston to talk about it. Ellen, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So, Ellen, one of your earliest memories that you share in the book is a moment of social anxiety you had in preschool. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. So this is my first memory. So I remember opening my eyes at rest time. There were perhaps 10 or 15 kids, I must have been about 3 or 4 at the time, resting on mats on the floor. And I remember opening my eyes and seeing my teacher, Mrs. Fish, lean over her guitar, which she would play, you know, soothing melodies so we would rest for a few minutes. And she said, "There you are, sweetheart. Good morning." And clearly I had accidentally fallen asleep during rest time. And I remember becoming aware that every other kid in the class was looking at me. And they were not laughing. There was no mocking happening, but I was the center of attention. And I was unprepared for it as well. And so there was this shot of adrenaline and panic. And I remember squeezing my eyes shut to try to make them all go away and make the eyes on me just disappear. And so I want to emphasize again that there was nothing untoward happening. I wasn't being bullied. It was just a moment of having lots of different people look at me at the same time, being that center of attention, and it just felt wrong. So that is for better or worse my first memory.
So you were in preschool when that happened. When does social anxiety tend to manifest? Is it usually in that young of a child, or do we see it develop more during the school years?
Sure. So it can happen at any age, certainly. The bulk of social anxiety begins between the ages of 8 and 15, which, if you think about it, makes sense because the tween and early teen years are when we are our most self-conscious. It's when we start to transition from caring about the opinion of our family and our parents more to the opinion of our peers. And so being aware that perhaps we are being judged or we're being watched becomes goes to the tip of our consciousness. And so that is when most social anxiety begins. Although again, many people I have talked to and work with say that they have been socially anxious from the minute they entered this world. So it can really begin at any age.
Can you kind of paint the difference for me between something that makes you feel nervous, like, you know, you're about to go on stage and do something or sit for the bar exam, and then true social anxiety? What is the difference? I mean, we've all felt nerves at some point. How can you draw a distinction? Or is there?
That is a great question. And that's a question I get a lot. And so I like to draw a distinction between kind of everyday social anxiety, the social anxiety we might feel in going to a job interview or giving a presentation or meeting our partner's friends for the first time, things that would give pretty much anybody some anxiety, and what I call capital S social anxiety, which is diagnosable social anxiety disorder. So when it crosses over into a disorder is when it causes disproportionate distress or impairment. And so, for example, let's take this interview, for example. So coming over to the studio, I was nervous. So when I tried to think about something else, my brain would keep coming back to, this interview. I had the urge to rehearse questions in my mind and think about what I would say. I had some physical symptoms, but I would say that it was all proportional to the task at hand. I would say 10, 20 years ago for me, this would have been much more difficult. I probably would have lost sleep for several days beforehand. I would have had GI problems for several days beforehand. And there, that, when it is disproportionate, when it causes inordinate distress or impairment. So, for example, if a student will consciously forego 20% of their class participation grade and say, well, I just can't raise my hand. I guess I'm just going to get an 80 at the max in this class. Or if someone will pass up a promotion because it would require that they start giving presentations or meeting with new clients or something like that, then, if it causes disproportionate distress or impairment in life, that's when it crosses that line into social anxiety disorder.
And I'm guessing there can be a lot of little day-to-day disruptions if you have social anxiety disorder. For example, I imagine someone who really doesn't like speaking up to make an order might grab packaged deli meat, out of the prepackaged section so they don't have to go up to the counter and say what they want. Is that something you find that people just change the patterns of how they'd like to live and work just to avoid what makes them anxious?
Absolutely. So that you used the magic word, which is avoid. And so folks with social anxiety, and pretty much any of us who, when we experience social anxiety, because I want to emphasize that this is something that is near universal, that yes, we do structure our lives around that avoidance, that it is easier to go literally the long way around if we're worried about bumping into someone we know and having to make small talk. We will choose to do that. We might, we might only order food online so we don't have to call and talk to somebody on the phone. We might decide to take a class online as opposed to be in a real classroom. We might go to the party and do what's called covert avoidance. We might show up at a socially anxiety-provoking event, but perhaps only talk to the friend we came with, or stand in the corner and scroll through our phone and, pretend to check Twitter, or spend most of our time petting the host's dog. So there is overt avoidance, so not asking the question in class because we're worried we'll look stupid, eating lunch at our desk rather than in the break room with our colleagues because we feel awkward, avoiding parties altogether because we're worried no one really wants us there. And then there's that covert avoidance, which is showing up, but is keeping to ourselves or turning our attention inward so we are not really interacting and aren't taking any risks.
Is eye contact a big point of the covert avoidance as well?
Absolutely. Yes, that is. I would say that's the number one covert avoidance behavior. And it makes sense, quite honestly. All we're trying to do is keep ourselves safe. So social anxiety is based in this perception that we have a fatal flaw. And I want to emphasize perception, that this thing is not actually true or perhaps is true, but not to the degree that anyone would even notice or care. But there's this perception that we have a fatal flaw and there is something embarrassing or deficient about us that, unless we work hard to conceal or hide that fatal flaw, will be revealed and then will be judged or rejected for it. So a nice analogy that we can all relate to is the experience of looking in the mirror and seeing some kind of flaw. So maybe we have a zit, or maybe we're having a bad hair day, or maybe we're worried that our butt looks big in these pants. So there follows an urge to conceal. So perhaps we slap on some tinted moisturizer, or wear a hat that day, or change our pants. But if we were to go out in public like that without the concealment, we would feel self-conscious. We would feel like everyone was looking at us or judging us, and that there was nowhere to hide. And that sense is the same feeling of social anxiety, except instead of for the outside, instead of for our external self, it is for our internal self. And there are four categories that are the biggies, the big themes of social anxiety. One is actually the outside. It's concern about our appearance. So again, we're having a bad hair day, we have a blemish, we're fat, we're ugly. The second is the signs of anxiety themselves. So we might worry that we're going to blush and turn red and everyone will think we're weird, or that we're sweating through our shirt and that everyone will notice, or our hands are trembling, or our voice is quavering. So we're worried that people will notice this and make judgments about us. The third domain is our social skills. So people will think that we have nothing to say, or that we don't make any sense, or that we sound like a babbling idiot, or that we have no personality, or otherwise our social skills somehow are not up to par. And then the fourth, and this is what I come across most often in my practice, is a sense that we are somehow deficient in our entire personality or character. So, for example, that we're stupid, or that we're incompetent, or no one really wants us there, or that people are only putting up with us because they pity us. There's this sense that somehow we are not enough, and we have to work very hard to hide or conceal that in order to artificially tamp down our anxiety. And so to get back to your original question about eye contact, yes, so avoiding eye contact is a way of artificially tamping down that anxiety, trying to neutralize that anxiety and keep ourselves safe.
Talk to me about the socially anxious people who present as angry and irritated.
Oh my goodness, yes. So yeah, when we think about a threat, so in the animal kingdom, you know, a predator leaps out, and the two classic responses are fight or flight. And so a threat doesn't have to be physical, and it doesn't have to be external. A threat can also come from inside our heads and could be a social threat. And so say if we are giving a presentation and all the faces in front of us appear grumpy or bored, that's a social threat. Or even mm-hmm. here, more realistic than giving a presentation, say we're at a party and, you know, people don't seem to be engaging with us, or again have neutral expressions, there might creep up this sense that this is a threatening situation. I don't know if I'm accepted. I don't know if I'm safe here. And so what happens then is that classically we think about social anxiety as flight. We go hide in the bathroom. We go step out on the balcony to ostensibly to get some air, but really we're just escaping the situation. We have the urge to hide under the buffet table. So that's flight. But there are 21% of people with that capital S social anxiety disorder who manifest as fight. So they come across as prickly and grumpy and controlling and will insult you before you can possibly insult and reject them. And so they might come across as just kind of a pill or bitter, but really they're just scared. And so I liken them to a porcupine who's been scared, or a blowfish that has been startled, that they're really only acting that way because they are feeling threatened.
So the idea there is go ahead, they're going to jump ahead and do some of the work for the threat they perceive so that it can't get to them first?
Exactly.
And shy and socially anxious people have a lot of gifts too, right? Emotional gifts?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yes. I'm so glad you brought that up. I was hoping you would. So social anxiety is a package deal. And so, yes, there is this sense of wanting to hide or wanting to fight, but it comes along with all these other wonderful traits that, thankfully, as we work to get rid of social anxiety, to rise above social anxiety, these excellent traits don't go away, and they are.
And Ellen, actually, let's save those for when we come back from the break, because I want you to have some real time to go into that, and we're headed to break now. My guest this hour is Ellen Hendrickson, who's a psychologist. Her book is called How to Be Yourself, Quiet Your Inner Critic, and Rise Above Social Anxiety. Join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is psychologist Ellen Hendrickson. Her book is called How to Be Yourself, Quiet Your Inner Critic and Rise Above Social Anxiety. So, Ellen, before we went to break, we were talking a little bit about some of the kind of gifts that come along with the socially anxious personality. Talk to me about how they're kind of ahead of the curve in many respects.
Sure. So folks who experience social anxiety often have really high standards. Later, we can talk about how perfectionism can be a driver of social anxiety. But the flip side of that is that folks have quite high standards. They do good work. They're very empathetic. There's a definite connection and ability to empathize with others. Folks with social anxiety are pro-social, meaning helpful and altruistic. We care about others. And certainly when it goes too far, we care about what others think of us. But in general, it comes from a wonderful root of pro-sociality. Folks with social anxiety are good listeners. We're conscientious. And importantly, we work really hard to get along with others, which in an increasingly diverse 21st century world is going to be a really important skill.
Why is social connection so important and loneliness so destructive?
Oh, that's a great question. So social connectedness is... So, okay, let's back up. So in prehistoric times, when we relied on each other, we needed to be part of a group just to survive, just to find food or to create shelter. And even though now we live in the age of online food delivery and, you know, potable water and whatnot in the developed world, we still need the group for love and belonging and connection and community. And that is a fundamental need as much as the need for food or water or shelter. And so this need is never going to go away. And so insecurity, therefore, is part of the human condition. Having those socially anxious moments, I would argue, is necessary because a healthy dose of self-doubt helps us monitor ourselves and our behavior. It's necessary to spark introspection. It motivates us to grow and change. And I like to say that we doubt ourselves in order to check ourselves and ultimately to get along better with our fellow humans. So as you mentioned at the top, you know, not only is insecurity part of the human condition, 99% of us have these socially anxious moments, but a total lack of insecurity is a sign of sociopathy, of things gone wrong. So, you know, being a sociopath or a psychopath. And so that is something that is why we we're wired to need each other. And so when we are not part of the group, loneliness is actually kind of like hunger or thirst. It is a feeling that our bodies create to tell us that we are missing something. And so when we feel lonely, it drives us to connect. And it makes us try to be part of this group that we need.
What's interesting to me, and I want to kind of get into both the genetic component of social anxiety and whether or not it's a learned behavior, but we have a call that's a bit related to that. So I think we'll go ahead and take that first, and then we can kind of dissect it. We're going to go now to BJ in Dallas. So BJ, go ahead with your question.
Yeah, my question is, this kind of triggered, I look forward to reading your book, is that this past weekend I was at this big family event, and it really triggered a lot of memories about how much I was teased, and I feel like a lot of my social anxiety developed in my family, and that it's just unrelenting, and just after this family event this weekend, I was just exhausted because I was so on guard about different relatives and things that just make my life miserable, and I feel like, you know, that's why I dread the holidays a lot of times, because I'll just get so much anxiety about that, whereas I can get up and speak before a group. So is that kind of a situation you're concerned about also for social anxiety?
That's a good question. What do you think, Ellen?
That's a great question. So social anxiety can come from many different roots. They all kind of end up blooming into similar flowers. But for some, it is simply genetic, that if you have a first degree relative, so a parent, a sibling, a child with social anxiety disorder, you have a 4 to 6-fold increased chance of also having the same disorder. So it's been shown there is a genetic link. So approximately 30% of people come to their social anxiety through an adverse traumatic experience, like bullying or like being very harshly judged or criticized. It could be in a family situation. It could be through school, but definitely an adverse slash traumatic experience can drive home this perception that there is something deficient or wrong with us, and we can internalize that and carry it with us, and again, feel like we need to conceal or stay on guard in order to not be judged or rejected further. And for others, it can happen just over a long, you know, decades of modeling. If we come from a family that didn't socialize much, or we just were taught that we had to be independent and that being too close to others meant that we were weak or something like that. If we were taught that others were not to be trusted, then there might also be this sense of social anxiety that did not come from a discrete event, but instead was kind of fed and watered over decades. So there are many ways to get to the same endpoint. And again, it doesn't manifest the same way in everyone, but there are enough commonalities that they can all be lumped together in this umbrella of social anxiety.
And I'm guessing BJ is not alone in dreading the holidays. That probably is something you hear often.
Absolutely not. I'd say that is probably the norm, for better or worse.
So talk to me a little bit about, we covered kind of how socially anxious people use avoidance to get away from something, whether it's covert or overt. Talk to me about endurance. What does it mean when someone who's socially anxious is enduring?
Sure. So that is when we do show up to the party. We do go into the event that makes us anxious, but we white knuckle it through and we just hold on until it's over, and then we can run out the door and, you know, get into our car or go home and say, phew, I'm glad I made it. It's like holding our breath underwater until we can pop up and finally gasp for air. And what happens there is we often are using what's called safety behaviors. And safety behaviors it's any behavior that we're using, again, to try to tamp down that anxiety, to try to neutralize that anxiety. Oftentimes, folks will turn their attention inward and will start rehearsing what they're going to say if they're worried they're going to sound stupid. Or they will suddenly become like acutely aware of their body and think, okay, well, should I stand this way or this way to come across as more casual? Did the person I'm talking to just glanced to the right? Does that mean they're bored? Does that mean that they want to get away? We're doing all the self-monitoring and using all these behaviors to try to come across as we wish, to try to do this impression management. But really, it's just to try to tamp down this anxiety. And what that does is it eats up all our bandwidth. And ironically, then there is very little bandwidth left over to pay attention to the moment, to actually listen to who we're talking to think about how to respond naturally in the moment, to truly be ourselves. There's even, you know, not enough bandwidth left over sometimes to not spill our drink on someone or to not trip over our own feet. And so that's why, especially in these socially anxious moments when we have this buzz of adrenaline and anxiety, that is when we do the things that we fear most. We trip or we run into someone or we spill our drink. And so those safety behaviors that we're using are really getting in our way. And so the best way to one of the best ways to try to lower that anxiety in a more natural way is to slowly let go of the safety behaviors and to see what happens. In studies, so Drs. Lynn Alden and Charlie Taylor are a dynamic duo of social anxiety research from the University of British Columbia, and they have done studies about just this, where they will have folks with social anxiety meet with a lab assistant and say, okay, let's have you two talk and get to know each other. And because this is a study, people are randomized into groups, and one group is asked to do the enduring, to just white knuckle it through, just try your best, you'll get used to it. And the other group is asked to drop their safety behaviors. So for instance, if normally they would avoid eye contact to try to tamp down their anxiety, they'd be asked, okay, well, let's do an experiment and see what happens if you don't do that. Let's see what happens if you do make eye contact with this stranger you're going to talk with for 5 minutes. And what happens is, in the first group, they report that their anxiety is high, they don't enjoy the experience, and the person they're talking to kind of picks up on their anxiety and rates them after the fact as less enjoyable to talk to. The second group, those who drop their safety behaviors, report feeling more authentic. They enjoy the experience more. They feel more present. They feel more authentic. And then the people they're talking to, these lab assistants, say that, you know, given the choice, they would prefer to have that person as a friend. They enjoyed talking to them more. And so when we drop all this management, then our natural self comes through, our interests, our curiosity, our personalities. And that is what people want to see. And so not only do we feel more comfortable, but we come across more as we wish we could as well.
So the safety behaviors, which are adopted to make the person feel more comfortable, are actually kind of pushing them down further?
Exactly, exactly. So, for example, Dr. David Clark at Oxford in England has written many, many studies on social anxiety, and some of the stories he tells about safety behaviors are really illustrative. So, for example, he worked with one man who decided that at a pub that he didn't want people to see his hand shaking as he held his drink. So he decided he would turn around every time he took a sip and then would turn back and reengage in conversation. And so he thought this was a great way to hide his shaking hand, but it came across as odd, and it came across as being, you know, disengaged with the conversation. He tells another story about a woman he worked with who would, before talking to someone, would kind of run through a pre-prepared list of topics in her head and would try to stick to those topics and the phrases or sentences that she had rehearsed. And so she thought this was a great way to get rid of her anxiety, tamp down anxiety, and feel more comfortable with conversations. But it came across as giving a lecture, or as if she wasn't really listening to the person she was talking to. So, and I've seen this with my own clients, where if I'm working with a lovely gentleman right now who, when he encounters a neighbor on the street, he will say hello, he'll be friendly, he'll say hi, but keep on walking and make it clear that, well, and it comes across as clear that he does not want to talk, that he is either too busy or doesn't like them, but really he's just nervous. He's trying to keep himself safe, and that's his safety behavior, to always be on the move. And it comes across exactly the opposite of how he intends and feels.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. I was fascinated by the idea of the socially anxious extrovert. Tell me what life is like for those people.
Oh, that's so difficult because, okay, so introverts have a lower tolerance for stimulation and are, you know, more inner-directed, often quieter. Extroverts get their energy from people and get their energy from interacting and need more stimulation. And so if you are both an extrovert but you are prone to social anxiety, you're really between a rock and a hard place, because you crave being around people but are frightened of them. And so you have this choice of either feeling scared and anxious or feeling sluggish and bored because you're not getting your energy. And so this is a very difficult place to be in. I talked recently to, I was interviewed by someone who identified as a socially anxious extrovert, and he was both a teacher and a stand-up comedian. So he loved being in front of people. He loved having an audience, but was always scared that they were judging him and they didn't really want him there. So it was a very difficult place for him to be, and is a difficult place for any socially anxious extrovert to be.
So we're a little over a minute or so away from the break, but before we get there, could you kind of introduce the topic of the inner critic and how it trips you up? I mean, we've talked about it throughout, but just really define what that inner critic is and how does it disrupt you and put hurdles in your path as you're moving through your day?
Sure. So in a nutshell, the inner critic is that voice in your head that makes little commentary as before, during, and after a social situation. So thinking, oh, I hope you don't screw this one up, or why did I just say that? I hope I didn't sound like an idiot. I hope they don't see my hands shaking. Should I stand this way? Should I stand this way? It's like having a loud radio in the background that is undermining you as you try your best to be yourself.
And I know this might sound like a bizarre question, but I mean, how reliable is the inner critic? Is the inner critic based on anything factual, or is it really all just what you perceive and fear?
Oh, well, what makes social anxiety a disorder is that it is based on this distortion, is that the inner critic is lying and is wrong, and that the things it says are either not true at all, or maybe there's a grain of truth. Perhaps you do have trouble with word finding and trip over your words a bit, but probably nobody even notices. And even if they do, they're not going to judge or reject you to the extent that the inner critic foretells.
And one thing you said that really caught my attention is you said the inner critic can be hesitant. What does that mean?
Sure. So the inner critic both wants you to succeed. Like the inner critic is really trying to keep you safe. It's trying to keep you from being rejected. But at the same time, it criticizes you very harshly. And so it's this really mixed message that and it can kind of seem to give you mixed. It gives you misinformation in many ways.
My guest this hour is psychologist Ellen Hendrickson. Her book is called How to Be Yourself, Quiet Your Inner Critic and Rise Above Social Anxiety. Join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or tweet us at KERAThink. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is psychologist Ellen Hendrickson. Her book is called How to Be Yourself, Quiet Your Inner Critic and Rise Above Social Anxiety. So you've spoken a lot about kind of the roots of social anxiety and how it shapes people's day-to-day and even year-to-year lives. Let's talk about kind of making some progress. Can mindfulness exercises make a difference in how people live with social anxiety?
Yeah, so mindfulness is a word that has become quite overused and trendy, but it truly is something that can help rein in the social anxiety. So this ties into a tip that I talk about in the book called Turning Your Attention Inside Out. So like I talked about before, when we're in a socially anxious moment, our attention tends to turn inward. We start to monitor what we're doing. We start to get in our own heads a bit. And so a nice way to root ourselves in the moment and really try to be mindful is to turn our attention inside out, that instead of tuning into what I referred to as that loud radio in the background of criticism, that we focus instead on where we are. We focus on who we're talking to. We listen very closely to what they're saying. We can look at the environment around us and essentially pay attention to anything except ourselves. And that will root us more in the moment and free up that bandwidth that I was talking about and allow natural curiosity to fill in the gaps. We'll have questions come to mind when we truly pay attention to what our conversation partner is saying, rather than having to like white knuckle it through or to use something we've pre-rehearsed beforehand. We can really be in the moment, engaging naturally by turning our attention from the inside to the outside, to the environment around us.
Let's take a call now. We're going to go to Nona in Arlington. Nona, go ahead with your question.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Wow. I just turned on the radio about 15 minutes ago, and I'm blown away. Socially anxious extrovert has me written all over it. So I'm in a rock band. You know, when I'm there, I'm social, I'm comfortable, I'm like, you know, I'm the host of the party, and then I go out to a store or to work, and that inner critic kicks in, and it's, you know, I'm inferior, I don't belong here, I get frustrated with myself if I don't learn something on a job fast enough, and that comes out of my mouth. I don't know how to explain it other than people think I'm negative, when really what it is I'm angry with myself because I feel so completely stupid and inferior. What kind of, I know this is way too much to, you know, give a pat answer to, but can you suggest any, and I'm going to buy the book, absolutely. Oh, my gosh. But can you suggest any tools to kind of deal with that, especially in the workplace?
Good question.
Yes. So it sounds like, quite honestly, you may have already solved your own problem. So you said, you know, you're a rock star, you're a host, and when you're in a role that you feel okay, and that it's only when you're out of that role, again, like you're at work or you're kind of on your own at a store, that it gets to be, that the social anxiety wells up. And so you have stumbled upon a secret, a well-kept secret of giving yourself some structure. And so you can do that in other areas of your life as well. So to give yourself a role to play, a mission to fulfill, and so that can be done formally. So for instance, you know, if you're a member of an organization, a well-kept secret is to take on a leadership role. And that gives you a reason to talk to everyone. You have a duty to fulfill. But it can also be done informally or on the fly. So like if you're at a party, you could assign yourself the task of talking to three new people. Or if you are in the lunchroom at work and you're feeling anxious, you could give yourself the assignment of saying hello to somebody and saying, oh, is anyone sitting here? Giving yourself some structure can take away the biggest driver of social anxiety, and actually all anxiety in general, which is uncertainty. And so there's a lovely study that I just want to talk about as illustration. So a study by Simon Thompson and Ron Rappe, these are Australian social anxiety researchers. So they took women who were at the top and bottom of the continuum of social anxiety. So women who scored quite high on a social anxiety questionnaire were, you know, probably capital S socially anxious. And then also women who were the opposite of that, who were confidently chatty, had never met a stranger, you know, talked to everyone wherever they went. And one at a time, they sent them into this experiment, which unbeknownst to them, began the second they walked into the waiting room. So they walked into this waiting room and they were joined by a lab assistant who they thought was also another participant. And the participant, or the lab assistant, said to them, oh, hope we don't have to wait too long, and then waited to see if conversation ensued. And every 30 seconds, this lab assistant would kind of drop another comment. And this went on for 5 minutes. And so just whatever conversation happened, occurred. And then after 5 minutes, the researchers came in and they said, okay, thank you guys for coming and for participating today. Here is your assignment. In the next 5 minutes, we'd like you to pretend that you're at a party and to get to know each other as well as you can. So go, 5 minutes. And later, these 2 5-minute segments were, so they were taped and they were reviewed side by side and rated for like kind of social, not skills, because social competence, let's say that. And predictably, the women with social anxiety came out, you know, quite a bit behind in the first 5 minutes. So, like, not much was said or it seemed awkward. But in the second 5 minutes, where they had some structure and they had an assignment, the two groups were nearly neck and neck. And I want to, again, remind folks that the women with social anxiety, this is compared to people who basically do not have social anxiety, again, or confidently chatty. And so their performance was pretty much the same, which is astounding when you think about it. So just giving yourself an assignment or a mission can really take away that uncertainty and allow you to feel better and also to come across more as you intend.
So we got an email question from Jared in Plano, and he writes that, "I frequently will show physical signs of anxiousness and excitement, such as trembling hands, mild twitching, chattering teeth, when on a date with someone I feel particularly attracted to. However, mentally, I feel confident and safe. Can signs of social anxiety be subconsciously evident while we are fully aware and confident?"
That is a great question. So, yes. And I think what matters there is that he feels confident. He, you know, is able to engage. Sounds like his body is going a bit rogue. But generally, if he can be engaged in the conversation, to be present, I am willing to bet that the physical manifestations are probably not noticeable. And even if they are, the fact that he's feeling confident and you know, seems to be in the moment and engaged means that I'm willing to bet that the date will probably overlook those. Because we think that we have to come across as, you know, competent and confident at all times. But really, instead, when we ask people what they're looking for in a friend or a date or a romantic partner, it's warmth. It is being kind and friendly and trustworthy. And what folks with social anxiety usually think is that people are looking for them to perform well, to be competent, to be confident. But really, it's just people just want us to be friendly and engaged and to connect.
What is a challenge list?
A challenge list. So the best way to slowly conquer social anxiety is to do the very things that you're afraid of. And I know that sounds awful, but what happens is, so oftentimes I will have folks with social anxiety come into my office to work with me for social anxiety treatment, and they will say, "I wish I could just press pause on my life and retreat from the world and kind of work on myself and do this therapy and then reemerge like a butterfly from a cocoon and then go and live my life and be confident." And I say, "That's awesome. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're motivated. Let's do that in the opposite order. Let's have you live your life in order to gain confidence." Because what happens is it's kind of like the relationship between motivation and mood. We often think we have to be motivated to do something. We have to feel like doing something before we do it. We have to feel like going to the gym before we go work out. We have to feel inspired before we sit down to work on our novel. But really, we need to reverse those and just get started. We can lace up our shoes and go to the gym. And then what happens usually is our mood catches up. We're glad we went. We're happy we're there. We just start sitting, we sit down at the computer and just start writing, and then inspiration hits. So it's the same thing with confidence and action, that we wish we could feel confident first and then go off and do things, but really we have to do the thing. And then by experiencing it, we see ourselves doing it, and then we start to believe we can do it. And that's how confidence is built, to do something that's a little bit hard and say, "Oh, the worst case scenario that my inner critic was predicting didn't happen. And also, hey, I'm competent. I can handle this. I can do this." And, you know, little by little, as we add little drops to that bucket gets filled and we gain confidence. And so by stretching and growing and pushing ourselves to do little challenges, and we can make this into an actual list of things that we want to do, some the things that are so concrete that we can check them off on that list, we can really see our progress. And as we move through the list, what happens is what I call the moment, is when we find ourselves in a situation that previously would have made us socially anxious, and we do the thing unthinkingly and then realize, "Hey, I never would have flagged down a waiter for extra ketchup before. I never would have shown up to a Super Bowl party without fretting about, you know, who was going to be there and, you know, checking the guest list and being very anxious. I never would have walked into a store and browsed around and then left without purchasing anything and not feeling guilty. So that moment only happens in retrospect. It only happens when we do something and then realize how far we've come. But that moment is truly priceless. And I promise it to folks who come in for therapy, and we work together and have them do these things on their challenge list, the very things that they are afraid of.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. And aren't you doing number 7 on your challenge list right now?
Oh, doing a live radio interview. Yeah. So I'm actually glad you said that, because it can be part of how the sausage is made, kind of revealing what's occurring. So interviews are difficult for me. And like I said before, coming over here, I was nervous. But after now doing this many, many times, it's proportional. And I can say I'm having my own little moment right now where, you know, at the beginning of my learning how to be interviewed again, I would have lost sleep and been really kind of a wreck. And instead, here I am. And it's possible. And I know that, well, and then also, this was number 7, meaning it was something that was quite high on the list. That was something that was very difficult. But as you practice and as you gain confidence and experience and refute those 2 lies that social anxiety tells you, that the worst case scenario will happen and that you can't handle it anyway, the things that were at the tippy top lose their claws. They are not as difficult anymore. And so really, you never have to do the things that are really difficult. You never have to do a 10 as a 10, because as you work your way through, those 10s will kind of deflate and become more like 6s or 5s or 4s. And so that's a nice little secret that I like to tell folks as they embark on the journey. You never really have to do the things at the top of that mountain.
So we're very nearly out of time, but why do you say that social anxiety is not really a skills problem, that it's a confidence problem?
Sure. So there are no social skills deficits in social anxiety. Again, this is the social anxiety is based on this perception that there's something wrong or deficient about you. And that when we take away the fear, when we put people with social anxiety in a situation that they are comfortable with, where they are not feeling social anxiety, their social skills are completely fine. And it's simply thinking through the buzz of anxiety or the impression management that makes it feel like our social skills have evaporated, but they are in there, and we just have to turn our attention inside out, give ourselves some structure, lay off the perfectionism, and work our way through situations that challenge us, and we can feel like ourselves.
My guest this hour was Ellen Hendrickson. Her book is How to Be Yourself, Quiet Your Inner Critic, and Rise Above Social Anxiety. Thank you so much for your time, Ellen.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.